ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, I'm Claire Nichols, and what a special episode of The Book Show I have for you today. Two big name writers, both grappling with ideas of identity and what it means to write from the minority. Later, you are going to hear from Nam Lee. He sent critics into raptures with his debut, The Boat, in 2008. And I think everyone expected the big novel to come soon after that. But as you'll hear from Nam, he's not really into doing what people expect. And my first guest, she is finally here. It's R.F. Kuang and Yellowface. If you haven't read Yellowface yet, I'm sure you've heard about it, but just in case, here's the cheat sheet. Yellowface is about June, a white woman and middling author who steals the unfinished manuscript of her recently deceased, far more successful Asian-American frenemy, Athena. June polishes up the manuscript, she sends it to her publisher as her own work and gets published to global stardom while we wait for her inevitable fall. Yellowface is about lots of things. It's about identity politics, cancel culture, discrimination, but it's also about the way a blockbuster book is made. So it's fitting that the book has now become a blockbuster in and of itself. Rebecca Kuang, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Can we start maybe getting a bit confessional, Rebecca? Can you tell me, do you read Goodreads reviews?
I used to. So what I would do is I would go and filter for the 5-star reviews so I could read something as a pick-me-up, a bit of validation, a bit of encouragement. Everybody gives the advice that you should never look at your own reviews. And I learned pretty quick with my first book that it never helps to see the 1-, 2-, 3-star reviews. So fortunately, I've had a pretty healthy attitude to them throughout the years. And these days, I just never log on to Goodreads at all. So I've gotten to a place of more and more zen about the whole thing. But I definitely understand the attraction and really the undeniable impulse when you're early in your career. You just want to know so badly what people think of your work.
And I think the filtering is such a good idea, right? Because when you're feeling maybe a bit flat, a bit down in the dumps, you can just go read those 5-star reviews and have that feeling of admiration just wash over you.
It's just really nice to know that what you wrote, the story you created, has resonated with somebody else. I think there's an author and a programmer who made possibly a Chrome extension, don't quote me on this,
okay,
that you can install to set Goodreads to only show you the 5-star reviews. And I never figured out how to download it, but it would have been a really nice tool to use early on.
So as you mentioned, you had published before Yellowface, you'd published 4 fantasy novels. Rebecca, tell me how lonely is the life of a writer?
I don't find it very lonely. And the parts that are set in solitude are deliberately so, at least for me. I really have to block out everybody and everything to focus and think. I'm not one of the authors that has critique partners or workshops with a regular group. I really like to be the single creative mind in the room until the thing is in some workable shape, and then it goes off to my agent, and then my agent and editor hack it apart. So I do allow other voices into the creative process at some point, but not when I'm writing. I think that ability to be alone with yourself is very important, and that's good. On the other hand, you need community, and you need people to vent your ugly feelings to and to reassure you that what you're doing matters, and also to remind you that there are other things that aren't writing. There's a whole world of clean air and blue sky and green leaves on trees to feel and touch and escape from the work for a little bit. And I've been really fortunate throughout my career to have that strong community and friends that are with me in person to pull me out of my work hole every now and then. So I'm alone when it's important and not alone when it's important. And I think that's been such a wonderful balance to have.
I'm so glad that you have more support than, I was about to say, the hero of this novel, the anti-hero, the protagonist at least, June, who is very, very lonely in her writing life. You were talking about those ugly feelings, Rebecca? Are they ugly feelings about your own work? Are they ugly feelings about other people's work? What are the ugly feelings that you have to encounter in the writing room?
Ugly feelings about everything. These days, I mostly have ugly feelings about my own work. I go through these cycles where I hate everything I've ever written. I devour prose by other authors I admire, and I'm just filled with this horrible jealousy and despair. I was reading a collection of great American essays last night, and I thought, well, what's the point even? I'm never going to write like this. I'm never going to observe the world around me so astutely or write such a clean line of prose. So I should just give up. It's really frustrating. And of course, certainly earlier in my career, I had a lot of insecurity and jealousy towards other authors. I always felt like people were achieving things that made me terrified because I wondered when that would ever happen for me. And it was especially tough when it was an author near my age or another Asian American author, and I'd be filled with this self-doubt and bitterness, thinking, what are they doing right that I'm not doing right? And it was horrible. And the thing is, though, I think all of these feelings are healthy to have, and these feelings are fine. Even jealousy is a fine feeling and something that can be really motivational. Jealousy is great to feel if you are able to harness it to light a fire under you and push you to achieve more in your own work rather than manifesting as venomous actions towards other people. So I don't think it's really a question of having ugly feelings, which everybody does, and more a question of who are you communicating to them to, how are you venting them, and how are you responding to them. And the difference between me and June, right, is that June has no healthy way of dealing with ugly feelings.
What do you do? How do you vent? What is the best way to do it?
Well, these days I am an addictive letter writer. So, and not long form by hand, because my hand doesn't have the patience for that. But I produce just volumes and volumes of emails to a group of close friends. And you know, when people are exhausted of reading my correspondence, they can tap out at any point. But last night, I wrote the email about the essay thinking, well, you know, nobody our age is writing about this. Nobody in our generation can write like this. So why don't we all just give up? Why are we even trying? And just the act of articulating these feelings and putting them out there on an email chain for other people to respond to, refute, pick apart, or sympathize with, it feels really nice. And it feels nice especially to have a trusted circle of interlocutors who you know will engage you in good faith and take you seriously at your word and read your arguments charitably rather than strangers on your internet who are looking for the worst possible way in which to interpret you.
I love how honest and vulnerable you're being, Rebecca, because I think there'd probably be a lot of people, and maybe it's those people on the internet, who will say, Rebecca's doing fine. She published Yellow Face. At this point, you kind of are the Athena of your novel, right? Like, you are the winner. Is that something you could ever imagine for yourself?
I think I dreamed about my work having the kind of reach that it does now, but I don't think anybody can really imagine accurately how it feels to have produced a novel that's gotten so much attention. And I think what people don't know especially is that it doesn't really make you happier on the other end.
Oh, no.
First of all, the amount of exposure is really terrifying. It makes you second guess everything you say at every point. But also, at least for me, I'm very bad at taking credit for accomplishments, and I'm bad at celebrating. So I just feel vaguely guilty every time I'm congratulated on this book. And it's in part because the timelines don't match up for me, right? This is a book that I wrote in isolation in 2021. It's 2024 now, so it's been 3 years. The period in which I was alone with the book, tinkering with the sentences and really thinking carefully through everything I wanted to express, feels like it belongs to a different part of my life. So I feel like I'm several years ahead of everybody I encounter who is meeting me through my work for the first time. It feels a bit like I'm taking credit for a test that I cheated on or a test that I didn't take. And the only way I can deal with this vague guilt and anxiety about resting on my laurels really is to be focused on the next thing. But again, the next thing is something private that exists only on my laptop and is a real book only in my head. So I think nobody really ever anticipates the ongoing insecurity and frustration with your own prose that comes even with being a successful novelist.
And is there another voice there now in the head as well because of that success? Are you feeling like the next book has more pressure on it because you know more people are going to be reading it, more people are going to be judging it?
Oh, absolutely. I felt this way ever since my first book came out. I thought, well, the next one's going to be a massive disappointment and everybody will hate it and it will be revealed that I was an imposter all along and that I never could write. I was just faking it until I made it. So I'm used to that pressure now and I'm used to the sinking feeling of expecting that the next book isn't going to do so well. I'm always waiting for the other shoe to drop. But what's different now going into the sixth book versus going into the second, third, fourth book is paradoxically that because the pressure is so immense, I feel freed a bit to do whatever I want and get weird and explore and try to grow creatively because I already know there's nothing I could possibly write that is going to match the feeling of reading Yellowface. Yellowface already exists. I'm not going to write a sequel in the near future. So there's nothing that can imitate the highs of that project. That means I just have to run as fast as I can in a different direction and try out a different voice, a different plot structure, a different literary style, and try to succeed on my own terms there. So that does feel a little bit better. But yes, every day I am beset with crippling anxiety.
Oh, Rebecca, I'm so sorry to hear that. I hope at some point you can celebrate how wonderfully successful you've been.
Oh, I don't like celebrating, though. I like pushing myself.
All right. Look, I'd love to go back to the start, how you got here, Rebecca. When did you know you wanted to be an author?
I think the questions of when I wanted to be an author and when I wanted to write are distinct. And I knew I wanted to write since I was able to write. I was just always doing it. I was always doing it for fun. I was always keeping a diary or writing fan fiction. Even before I knew what fan fiction was, I was writing little stories about myself and Luke Skywalker, my best friend. And it's just always been this compulsive habit for me. I couldn't imagine. There was never, ever a period where I wasn't actively working on something. But for most of my childhood and really up through college, I never wrote with an eye for publication. So I encounter creative writing students these days who tell me that they've been submitting to short story contests and to magazines since they were in high school. And I think, thank God I didn't know about these contests when I was in high school because I think I would have driven myself crazy. I'm reading a biography of Sylvia Plath right now by Heather Clark called Red Comet. It's very good. And it describes how really since she was in high school and as an undergrad, she was constantly submitting to literary magazines. And there's this lovely line where she writes about Adrienne Rich, who later became a successful poet herself. And she's thinking, who is this woman at Yale who's 2 years ahead of me, who's so much more published than I am? What does she have that I don't? And I think getting into the industry too young and worrying about publication and worrying about acceptance would have just destroyed me. So maybe it's good that I didn't know about any of that. But what happened for me is I went to China on a gap year between my sophomore and junior years of undergrad. And I wrote my first book. And then I thought, oh, wouldn't it be fun if we tried to get this published? And then one thing led to another. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is real. It is going to be published and I'll see it on shelves. And when it was sold, it sold as part of a 3-book deal. So I knew whatever else I was doing for the next 5 years, I would certainly be finishing out that trilogy. So stumbling into a career as a published author is something that only crossed my mind as viable when I was in college, but I have always loved writing.
So that first series was the Poppy War series, and it was set in a fantastical version of China. I wonder, and I'm thinking about this because of having read Yellowface, Rebecca, did you ever feel pigeonholed by the industry, or did you feel there was any sort of pressure on you as a Chinese American woman to write certain types of fiction?
The thing is, I was writing what I was passionate about, and I wanted to explore Chinese history. I wanted to make legible all these stories and mythologies and aspects of history that I had not been taught growing up and that I'd only recently learned about. So I didn't feel like I was choosing a subject matter because that was the expectation. It's after the book was published and we were thinking about publicity and marketing and all the little institutional things like where you get shelves in a bookstore and what lists you get included on, etc., that I realized is that my public identity as an author was really being shoehorned into a very specific kind of minority literature, which is you read these authors if you want to read some Chinese American authors to step outside of your comfort zone and read something different for a change. But it seemed that in those early years, nobody ever recommended my books just on the strength of being good fantasy novels. I think things have changed over the last few years, hopefully for the better. But in those early years, I felt like I and other Chinese American colleagues who all wrote pretty different stuff were constantly being lumped together for no other reason that we all happened to be born in China or our parents were born in China. And this was very frustrating to me.
Yeah. And I guess from this came this novel, Yellow Face. This is a book that really challenges the reader. I think it's meant to make us feel uncomfortable. How ready were you in the writing room to really push that, to really just go for it and see how far you could go with this book?
I don't think it was a question of readiness. I think it was a question of sheer boredom. Because you have to remember, this book was written during 2021, during lockdown. And when you're alone in an apartment for that long, when the only interaction you've had with most of your friends and colleagues has been over the internet, there no longer is a line of what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, what's safe, what's dangerous. I was just writing for the sheer intrigue because I would lose my mind from boredom if I didn't work on something that really pushed my boundaries and made me excited and terrified me a little bit. If I played it safe at any point, then this book never would have been written because I would have put down the project and wandered off to something else.
Wow. Have you been surprised by how much readers have just lapped up that discomfort and said, "We love it, give us more"?
I'm actually not surprised at all because I know that people love cringe humor. I know people love The Office and shows like Succession. So, I mean, the most uncomfortable scenes in the book, I knew people were going to be thrilled by because it's very much my sense of humor. I love writing about the most uncomfortable thing that can possibly happen. Sometimes my fiance and I, in totally normal social situations, like to joke about, oh, what would happen if I just sat down on the floor and took off my pants? Like, we like to dream up awkward situations for each other. We think it's very funny. And I think a lot of people think this is very funny. So I think I knew that it would go over well.
What about with publishers? I mean, this is a book that is so critical of the publishing industry. There were moments reading it when I wondered, how on earth did you actually get this through the publishing house?
Well, you have to remember that publishing is not homogenous, and that for every exhausting executive who's making a casually racist comment in an acquisitions meeting, there is also a lot of really eager young blood and editors and publishing assistants who are in there for the love of the story and their love of authors. And I was very fortunate because that's the team I got to work with, and all of them had horror stories of their own experiences in publishing. So at no point was I told, oh, you need to take this out because it's too on the nose. If anything, my team was whispering more gossip to me and encouraging me to get sharper and more vicious in the satire. And I never have felt terrified of retribution. I'm really fortunate in that regard.
I mean, this book really reveals how the publishing industry works. And you write in this book about novels getting anointed by the publishing houses. You know, the book is picked as the winner well before it's sold. You know, the publicity machine makes a bestseller happen. Is that the story of Yellow Face? Is that what happened?
So a bit yes and no. So the part that you're quoting is June's perception of how the industry works. She thinks that everybody is in cahoots to basically decide which books are going to be bestsellers and which books are not going to be. And she's halfway right, because it's true that how well a book performs sometimes depends on how much in-house support it's getting. People just do get different marketing budgets, and publishers will hedge their bets and place their and throw their support behind different titles depending on how they think they're going to perform in the market. But that being said, there's absolutely nothing anybody can do to 100% guarantee that a book's going to be a bestseller. It's very common, actually, to see books get a tremendous marketing push, and then when they come out, just absolutely crickets. So things have to line up pretty well. You both have to have that in-house support, which I was very fortunate to get, but you also have to have written something of value that readers resonate with. And in this case, I feel really lucky that it was both the book that got that support and also seemed to spread organically with readers who just liked what they read. And hopefully that'll be the case with books I write in the future, but we'll see.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's get into this book a little bit deeper, Rebecca Kwong. It's narrated by June Heywood. She's a writing rival to Athena Liu. And she is a frenemy. They hang out together, but she's seething with jealousy about Athena's success. And underneath that jealousy, there's also a level of racism, right? Because she thinks that a lot of Athena's success comes down to the fact that she is a person of colour.
Right.
It made me wonder if a person of colour can ever just enjoy their success, or if there's always an internal fear that, am I the chosen person? Is this a tokenistic thing? I mean, that must be a horrible way to exist.
Well, I can't speak for all people of colour, but this is something that worries me all the time. I do wonder if my work is doing well generally because it's good work, or because people are reading me out of some vague guilt that they ought to read more diversely, or that I am the token figure of the moment. Something to always remain quite cautious about. And also, it's a good ethical caution to have, because it's very common, actually, for people, not even people of color, anybody from a marginalized community, to reach a place of relative status and privilege and decide, oh, well, if I made it here, then it can't possibly be difficult for everybody else. But the thing to remember constantly is that you are the exception. You've been let in for some reason. Maybe that does have to do with your hard work and talent, but in many cases, a lot of things just lined up well for you. And that doesn't mean that you can just turn around and forget everybody else in community. It means that you constantly have to be vigilant about setting the ladder back down and thinking, how can I create more spaces for other people who look like me? So I try to remain constantly aware of this.
Athena and June, I don't think either of them like each other much. Why do they keep hanging out?
Have you ever had a friend that you secretly hate?
I don't know. I don't know if I would have a friend who I secretly hate and continue to hang out with them. I do like looking at their Facebook, though, and thinking mean things about them.
So I think that compulsion to catch up with people you despise on Facebook is just June and Athena's dynamic. But in real life, I think they have a pretty unhealthy, codependent, and obsessive relationship where they are dependent on one another's validation and they constantly seek each other's approval, but they also are in complete contempt of the other and looking for reasons to put them down. So it's not a typical friendship. I'm happy to say it's not described any of my close friendships, but I think this is quite common, especially in highly competitive circles.
I will agree with June on one point. I do find it insufferable that Athena writes on a typewriter.
I do too. I don't have a typewriter.
I mean, do you know anybody that actually does that?
I actually did have a writing instructor who I met in 2017 who brought in a typewriter. And I think there's something about the tactility, the pleasure of hearing the keys tap against the paper that inspires something creative in her. But of course, she's also careful enough to keep a digital copy of everything she writes.
Yeah, but Athena doesn't, because we need Athena to not have a digital copy, because otherwise the story's not going to work, I guess.
That's right.
Then Athena chokes to death on a pandan pancake. What an embarrassing way to die.
Well, I think it's less an embarrassing way to die and more just an absolutely terrifying way to die. I've always had an irrational fear of choking, and I think part of it is, and you can't call for help when you're choking, you can't say anything. So in college, I would call my now fiance, and we were in a long distance relationship then, and I'd say, well, if you're eating right now, then we can't talk because I'm so funny, and I'll make you laugh, and then you'll choke, and then you'll die. I know that you choke. Can't tell me about it over the phone. So I've been thinking about this for years and years.
Wow. Okay. So June steals Athena's manuscript. How does she convince herself that it is her right to use this story?
She doesn't take a lot of convincing. She is not thinking very rationally at the moment. So her desire to be published and to be widely acknowledged overrides every other ethical compulsion, I think.
And she's always justifying her actions to us, like she's telling us, you know, I did all the work on this. She just did the research. You know, Athena's writing wasn't good. I feel like she's trying to make it palatable for us, the reader, but she's trying to convince herself at the same time. Do you think she believes her own story?
I think June has to believe it. There's a passage in the text that says if she concedes this one thing, if she ever even admits to herself that maybe she shouldn't have the credit, maybe this is Athena's project after all and the world should know that, then the whole rest of the house of cards starts falling apart. So this is the fundamental lie that June can't let go of, even though she knows it has shaky foundations.
You know, I was speaking to Zadie Smith last year about her book, The Fraud, and we talked quite a bit about this idea that people can hold two truths in their head at the same time. And in the case of The Fraud, it is, I am Roger Tichborne and also I am not Roger Tichborne. But in this case, I think for June, it is, I stole this story. I know I stole this story, but also this is my story and I deserve it. It's a strange thing to be able to hold two truths in your mind at once.
Well, and she's not entirely wrong either. The final manuscript did involve a lot of her labor. The book wouldn't exist in the form that it does without her writing sensibility. And the worst part in all of this is that June's actually quite a talented writer. She knows what she's doing. She has an ear for the craft. She's well-read. It's just that her original work, for whatever reason, is getting the kind of acknowledgement that she wants. But this final creation that constitutes the last front really is a collaboration between her and Athena.
How much in the writing room did you see June as a villain, and how much did you empathize with her?
Oh, she's both a villain and completely deserving of empathy because she's less motivated by hatred towards others and more motivated by this terrible overriding insecurity. And I think we've all felt insecure about ourselves and our fields and our relationships with others.
Yeah, that's true. So you were able to channel some of that, of your own insecurity that you were talking about earlier.
Oh, I felt most of the emotions that June feels throughout the book. The difference is that I can immediately go to my group chat and tell people what I'm feeling so they can tell me I'm being silly.
Gosh, it's been so much fun to chat today. Thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you. I had so much fun.
And Rebecca Kwong's book Yellowface is published by the Burra Press. This is The Book Show, where you're in for another treat now. Here's some poetry from the Vietnamese-Australian writer Nam Le.
My mother wipes your mother's mouth, wipes her body clean and dry, wheels her outside to the shade, where wind and green tree leaves conspire, stirring dreams of aftermath. Sharp green craglands of the sea, waterlight of rainy glade. All the greens she didn't know she'd miss, the way a child, no, now fugitive in memory. My mother wipes your children's bums, smiles at their lordly cheek, bathes them, brushes teeth and hair, picks out jhanas and a book, then leaves you to your sacred time. Trams into the city next to clean your black meshed swivel chair, empty papers from your bin, vacuum where your feet have been, touching nothing on your desk. My mother paints and strips your nails, shaves your heels of remnant skin, kneads the bulk humectant in, stupefied from toluene and salicylic acid peels, she shudders to old ghosts of touch. Mouth on nipple, breast to chin, her children slung across her arms, smelling of their play, exclaimed since, so much, too much.
That's Nam Lee. Nam came to Australia as a refugee from Vietnam when he was only 1 year old. He published his short story collection, The Boat, in 2008. And it was a sensation. The book won a pile of awards, including the Australian Prime Minister's Literary Award, the Melbourne Prize, and the Dylan Thomas Prize. And now Nam is back with a poetry collection. And as you've just heard, it is beautiful and brutal, and it's called 36 Ways of Writing a Vietnamese Poem. Nam, thank you for that reading.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Oh, that was just beautiful. That was the start of the poem, Matre Immigral. Is this a poem about one mother, or is this a poem about a lot of immigrant mothers?
It's a poem about mothers, immigrant mothers, and it's a poem about poems about mothers and immigrant mothers. There's a sense that I'm trying to write about how mothers come to assume such a core and an potent place in immigrant narratives, and how the expectation that that's the case and that the turn to the mother is one that is rewarded is also a part of the narrative. And how does a writer, you know, write about mothers, about war, about immigration, about displacement, about loss and grief, without also recognizing that these are familiar and expected tropes that a Vietnamese writer or an immigrant writer would be expected to write about as well?
That's so complicated, Nam. You know, you're trying to avoid tropes.
Sorry.
No, but so you're trying to avoid tropes, but also you do want to write about your mum, right?
Oh, totally. I mean, this is, if I had to describe what I'm trying to do, and I guess what I've been trying to do ever since day one, it's always have your cake, eat it too. You know, I want to be really honest and truthful, I guess, with myself, but also with the readers, that nothing exists in and of itself by itself, ex nihilo. You know, everything comes primed with assumptions and expectations. The industry has its own imperatives, and people and their emotional configurations have, you know, grooves down which they're more likely to welcome an immigrant writer writing about certain things. And so I want to be really straight and honest about that. But yeah, I want to write about mums, maybe my mum, maybe a composite of mums. I want to write about my own experience and do so in a way where I don't feel as though I'm extracting or performing.
In the introduction, Nam, I was speaking about The Boat. I mean, that was such a sensation. That was 2008, and, you know, you were being spoken about as the next big thing in Australian writing. since then, you've published another book about David Malouf, but I think people were perhaps expecting the big novel that didn't come. What have you been up to? What have you been doing in the time since then, Nam?
Well, you know, it's been a long time, as you say. It's been a rough time in many ways, and it's been a joyous time in many ways as well. And I think I'm still writing a novel. Whether it's big or not depends on how much I'm culling and killing of it at any given moment. I think this is a question that sort of chimed with the question that I and other people were asking themselves, I guess, during the pandemic of, you know, what am I doing and what's important to me in the rapidly diminishing time that remains? And I guess that question morphed into one that I'd been thinking about ever since the boat, and maybe from before that too, about, you know, what are we doing when we're writing? Why do books matter? There is a sense that I've had to negotiate with and evade in whatever ways I can, beyond writing for other reasons or for other people or according to other expectations. And so the only thing that I can sort of bring to the question of what I'm writing and how and why is it's got to be truthful to me, you know. And so I guess beyond the idea of a book being a commodity, you know, something to entertain, which is obviously a really important and special thing, beyond it being a way of credentializing oneself, which I think is happening more and more, perhaps in sort of inverse correlation to the cultural importance of books, beyond signaling some sort of alignment with, you know, a line of thought or a tribe, and beyond even self-expression, I sort of want to think about, what am I doing? Can I write something that is true, that I stand behind, you know, 100%, even as the question and the notion of I changes all the time? And how do I do this in a way that is still respectful of, you know, the fact that it is a communication? There are readers out there, they have expectations and legitimate ones as well. And so I think it's been a question that's been roiling and boiling in me. And I hope that I'm, you know, doing what I can to be as sort of sincere and true to myself and to the work as possible.
It's interesting that in A Search for Truth you've turned to poetry, because this has always been a love of yours, right?
Yeah, for sure. It sort of predates everything.
So you wrote it, what, when you were a kid?
Yeah, I there was a stage, Claire, when I was only reading, I was that guy, you know, insufferable, and only reading and carrying books of poetry around and, you know, copying them and imitating them and like ripping them off and riffing off them. I was, you know, I was all about that for the longest time.
And so I'm guessing you would have been reading poems from the English canon, from the Western canon. This book is called 36 Ways of Writing a Vietnamese Poem. Where do you start when you're trying to explore what it is to write poetry as a Vietnamese refugee, as a migrant?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways you've just, you know, you've nailed the core of the question. It's because these questions are unresolved and irresolvable that I did turn to poetry. There's a notion that in poetry, for me anyway, I feel I can preserve my ambiguities a lot more. And I also want to convey the work not as an answer, not as a means to a message, but more as an invitation to a process, you know, an enactment, so to speak, you know, in mind time, both mine and the reader's, of what it is to be in this position and to be thinking about, how do I write in this language from this standpoint and from this history? And so in a way, you know, I'm very happy and grateful to be talking about this book, but of all of the work that I've done, it's this book that most conflicts me, because it feels as though I've spent all of this time, I've spent basically my entire life trying to negotiate, navigate, come to terms with and accommodate the, you know, the complexities and contradictions of what it is, you know, to write as me. And I feel as though maybe I've created a field of tension and contradiction which holds those ambiguities and that process of, you know, being led down one way and undermined and subverted and having multiple things that are exclusive, true at once. And to talk about it feels like I'm just destabilizing something that is already so delicately destabilized and unbalanced.
Well, why don't we let some of the poetry speak for itself then, Nam? maybe you can pick up the book and read us poem number 4. The title of this is Aegic All-Encompassing.
You can't go far wrong with violence. You'll go far, my boy. You'll cross oceans, my man. Start with the fall, go back or forth, through bombs or boats, across all the killing fields of thought. You can't make it up, because it's all yours, by blood, by right, by wrong done to your blood. Hold to trauma. Even if it never happened to you, you may claim it. Your blood contains it. What happened to them, your parents, theirs, or their kin, who don't talk about it because of what happened to them, is yours to take and tell. Their harm, your hurt, you may write it, for it is written in the very walls of your cells.
That's Nam Lee. Gosh, Nam, this is, must be the experience for so many second-generation migrants, right? This idea that you know about this trauma in your family, but it's not your trauma, but it is your trauma.
That's exactly right. And it speaks to, I think the satirical undercurrent in this poem is more, is closer to the surface, perhaps than in some other poems.
Yeah.
And it's the same interplay that we were talking about. You know, on the one hand, it is an extremely heartfelt, devastated lament and exhortation to oneself or to another writer to be brave and to explore that and to go there and to unravel those roots. And so many of the roots of immigrants are traumatic, you know, it sort of goes without saying. And at the same time, there is a trauma plot and a trauma industry that has, you know, arisen around that plot, where writers are expected to and rewarded for writing about, you know, ancestral or ethnic trauma. And there's an enormous, you know, resistance in me to being told what to do, you know, at all, or to be pigeonholed. And so this notion of, you know, you can write it because of who you are or some sort of line of epigenetic ancestry that you've uncovered feels to me like that one that's very ripe for exploitation and potentially, you know, fraud as well. So it's all mixed in there. It's palimpsestic, you know, it's all laid one atop the other. And, you know, part of, I guess, what I'm trying to communicate is that trauma is the reason for so many people, let alone writers, why they write. And for so many writers, the wound is where you go if you want to find the energy. But we also have to be mindful, I think, that trauma is also in a perverse way, it's a honeypot as well. And it can actually have the effect of encapsulating and commodifying and then absolving those people involved, you know, in the consumption of that trauma from any real deep consideration of that trauma or potentially even their complicity or culpability in that trauma.
I want to take a strange detour now, Nam, to talk briefly about poker. We didn't hear from you for a while writing books, and then you popped up on the professional poker circuit. What led you there?
I need to clear the record. It was never professional.
Never professional. Okay.
No. It was a hobby, and as with most things that I take on as a hobby, I kind of get into things, and so I started playing poker in Iowa actually when I went over there for my masters, and it was the peak period of pokerdom, and so it was just a natural thing that all these writers and poets and ruffians would get together and
basically talk shit and bluff and lose their money and drink, and, you know, establish a kind of sideways rapport with one another that way. And then I obviously just went down the rabbit hole and I took it a bit more seriously and started, you know, studying it and talking about it and playing it. And it was so interesting to me because, I mean, I could go on about it for, you know, for ages, but it was the perfect counterpoint to writing for me. You know, when I was playing, and I haven't played since 2016, it coincided with, you know, such a productive period in my writing as well, because it sort of used, you know, the absolute sort of other side of the brain. But while I was doing it, I was also taking a masterclass in psychology, in human psychology, you know, just sitting around the table and for hours and hours at a time and observing them, because observation is advantage, you know, in poker, and talking to them and getting to know people's tells and ticks and in some ways just reveling in one of the very few places where it felt as though all of the schisms and the tribalities and the walls that split us off from one another, when you're around a poker table, none of that matters as much as what's happening around the poker table. And so it felt to me, in a weird way, like the most joyful escape from so many of the strictures of, you know, society at large. And it was a place where people had to deal with each other as they were, because who they were suffused their style of play, which then affected the game and, you know, your chance to take their money.
So you were studying other people. I guess they were studying you at the same time now.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, how's your poker face?
I don't know. Like, I mean, I did all right. I was positive all up, I think. And the reason why I stopped playing actually was because when I became a father, when my daughter was born, I could no longer not think about the money as money. And to play properly, you have to think of the money as just a way of keeping score in a game. And when it matters to you, then, you know, the psychology also kicks in and you lose your edge.
So back to that very stable financial career of being a writer instead.
Well, you know, like I said, I'm pretty contrary. And, you know, when everyone's writing novels, I was writing short stories. And when, you know, all the other short story writers were writing linked collections, I went for the, you know, the scattergun hodgepodge dog's brekkie approach. And now, you know, when pretty much every poet I know is moving into prose, into novels and memoirs and essays, here's me sort of going in the other direction, you know, chasing the big bucks, as you say.
I'd love to finish with one more poem if we can, Nam.
Sure.
This is poem number 11, Violence, Anglo-Linguistic. But before you read it, perhaps we can just talk a little bit about writing a Vietnamese poem, but doing so in the English language.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is, again, this is one of the deep laments that the poem evokes, is that, you know, the very first poem, I'll see if I can find it actually. The very first line in the very first poem is, in English, mind you. And then it goes on to say, you dink I writey yik na me? Shame on you. It was your violence dumbed me. And for me, that shame, which the book will go on to demonstrate again and again, that shame is enormously inwardly focused as well, because I don't read Vietnamese, I don't write Vietnamese, and I speak it at a very basic level. And part of that is, you know, due to the circumstances of how I got here. Part of that is cultural, and part of that, frankly, is based in the roots of the trauma that we were alluding to before. So it's such a tender spot for me, thinking about what it is to be fluent in and to write in a language which my parents don't really read, and which is a palpable demonstration of my distance from my parents and from my natal soil, because I was born there, and from everything that that represents going back, you know, a long, 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 long time. So when I'm talking about writing a Vietnamese poem, I'm very much talking about it in one way from a caustic sort of point of view of this is where I am and I wish it were not so in some ways, but I'm also really glad that it is so in many ways, because I love the language and I love the ability of the language to actually contain and in some ways honour a lot of those tensions and ambivalences.
Okay, let's hear the poem.
Here we go. 11. Violence. Anglo-linguistic. Appetitive. Omnivorous. Expansionary. Atonal with smashed together consonants. It wants it all. Empire and industry. Science, technology, narratology. Transaction. One language to rule them all. Billions strong. The standard, the first and first second. Mitotic, mitogenic, mitochondrial. Ceaselessly dividing, changing, charging. It incorporates all, exiles all. We become internal emigres, exophones, our tongue, blood glutted, rapined, chrismed in Rome, hardened in old Germanic mouths, totalized. Bonded now to long Western bent, Western lexicology, logorrhea, lexithymia, Western grammar. Say it was said, what I will say, but not in English, in the norm script of pre-colonial Vietnam. Tongue, revolt. English demands, what is the function of each word? Is it pronoun, noun, or verb, adjective, adverb? What is its action? English demands, which is the subject? Which object? Whose tongue? How many? What gender or case? What is its article? English demands, what is the tense, the mood? Is the revolting or the tonguing transitive? To, against, whom, what? And when? Has it happened? Will it? Is it? What auxiliary for perfect and or continuous? As to whether, might it, should it, must it, would it. English, with its mind of closed grids, demands answers. Data, declension, denomination. But Vietnamese answers. I am all these things, or any. I am openness, manyness at once. Ontology. Your grammar is violence. Your way is narrow exaction. The way that lets itself be said to be the way is not the way. Nothing, I say, ha-ha, is more important than freedom.
Nam Le, thank you.
Thank you.
That's Nam Le. His poetry collection, 36 Ways of Writing a Vietnamese Poem, is published by Scribner. The Book Show is made on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. It's produced by Sarah Lestrange, and my name is Claire Nichols. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.